All right. So, don't worry. This slide is about what I'm not going to talk about. But I wanted to show it to you as an advertisement, because sort of most of you know that I started during my PhD to work on sort of theoretical models of evolution, with these quasi-species models and fitness landscapes with neutral networks and so on. And then when I went into my postdoc, I started more and more looking at DNA sequence data, genomic data, on the one hand to try and understand something about genome evolution, but on the other hand, I got very interested in regulatory networks, especially transcription regulatory networks. And so this is the other part, other side of the research we're doing in my group, and I would say this is now sort of probably time and investment of personnel that's working on this problem is much bigger than people that are working on genome evolution. This is why I wanted to advertise it. So this is some picture from a paper done together with in a collaboration with the Riken Institute in Japan, where we tried using lots of high throughput data to infer up initio a transcription regulatory network in differentiating human cells. And so this is what this picture shows. Every node here is a transcription factor. The size of this ball indicates how significant this node is for explaining expression patterns that are changing during this differentiation time course. And then the edges that you see from one ball to another ball, those are all predicted regulatory, direct regulatory interactions that are predicted by this sort of this probabilistic inference model that uses the high throughput data that have an independent experimental validation on them. So I'm only showing the edges that have an experimental validation. All right, so then.
What are the blue?
Okay, so blue are the ones that go down over time, red are the ones that go up over time. Things that are green, they're transiently changing, so they come back to where they were at the start. And then the color, if you're light blue, you go early. If you're dark blue, you go late. If you're orange, you go early. If you're dark red, you go late.
So the edges that are shown are the ones that come out of the model and the...
And have an experimental validation, yes. So the experimental validation is either an siRNA knockdown, so you see a direct response, a chip that says that that factor is binding to the promoter of that other transcription factor, or there is actually an experiment in the literature that has already established that direct link. And that's the three colors that you see in the edges.
Is there enough experimental data so that one can, or independent data, so then you get an idea of how good this reconstruction is, or is most of this a posteriori so that you can either just verify when they think there is an edge, or do you have a feeling how complete this is, or how good?
So let's put it like this. No, I actually don't know the answer to that, but my feeling would be that probably there's a lot that we're missing still. So this is probably some subset that we managed to have some validation for by one way or another. But the fact that you get these guys over here that are not connected to anybody is already showing you that, that probably you're missing a lot. Anyway, I just wanted to show you this. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, I'd be very, very happy to talk to you about what we do on these things. So this is also by way of introduction why I was agonizing quite a bit about what I should talk about today. About 2 years ago, right around the time when I was getting tenured in Basel, I decided that I wanted to try and start a wet lab, set up a wet lab. And so I invested a lot of time and effort in that. About 1 year ago, it actually started in the sense that I had a space and one person in it. And so as a consequence, basically the theoretical work on the genome evolution side has been sort of less of a focus in the lab. And as a result of that, I have a combination of some older work that I think is quite interesting, but that most, or let's say half of the audience haven't heard me talk about at least once, sometimes more than once. And some new work from the wet lab that is not really done yet is all work in progress. So I have to somehow combine these things. So what I decided to do is I'll start by saying something provocative, just to maybe, you know, get people's attention. And this is sort of a continuation of the discussions we were having last night about fitness and these things. Then I will give a very sort of compactified sort of background of you know, where my interests lie in genome evolution, where I try to focus my attention. And this is sort of mainly for people that haven't seen this stuff before. And then I'll talk about one ongoing new theoretical project, which is about inferring genome size distributions from metagenomic data. So this is the one theoretical project that we're working on. I'll say a little bit about macroscopic structure of transcription regulatory networks in the eukaryotes, and then the main thing that I like to show you about is one project from the lab, which is to evolve E. coli promoters from scratch, starting from totally random sequences. And we have another project in the lab, which I will not talk about. So this is Basel. You can swim in the Rhine in Basel. It's very nice in summer, and this is the place where I work, the Biocenter. All right. So it's more than 150 years ago since the publication of The Origin of Species. So we've had the theory of evolution for a very long time. And so the question that I'm sort of wondering about often is, why is there still no quantitative theory of evolution, in the sense that observations from the real world on evolving systems are sort of explained and maybe even predicted in some sort of quantitative framework, right? This we still don't have. And of course, there is a quantitative framework for studying evolution, and this is mathematical population genetics. And we've had about 100 years of mathematical population genetics now. When I look at what the sort of work is done there, it looks to me as a sort of, you're trying to bootstrap yourself up one complication at a time, starting from the very simplest system. So you start with a system that's incredibly simple, you know, one allele, maybe only selection, right? And then, you know, you add mutation, and then maybe try to add recombination, or you add some changes in population structure, or changes in population size, and so on and so on and so on. And there's incredible amount of progress being made, and we've learned a lot of things. And I think a lot of these theories are very impressive. But I also feel that even the most complex sort of mathematical population genetic models that people work with are still astonishingly far away from the actual processes that happen in the real world in evolution. So I think that it's very, very hard to get anywhere near the complexity of real world processes. And moreover, I think this is sort of the crux, it's not really clear which simplifications are appropriate for still describing stuff that's going on in the real world. And I've come to think that, so during my PhD, I was at the Santa Fe Institute, and my official supervisor was Pauline Hogeweg at the University of Utrecht. And a lot of people in those groups, in this institute, were setting up these sort of beautiful simulation worlds where you take a computer and you define a world in your computer that has, you know, any kind of complication you want. You know, you can have space and different individuals of space, and each individual has a genotype that encodes for their phenotype and how they behave, and then you can, you know, have some sort of distribution of food in the world, or some rules of how these individuals diffuse around and how they interact with each other and how they evolve. And then you can ask, okay, then you can just look and simulate it and ask what happens over time. And so there are lots and lots of people that are doing lots of these simulations to try and get some idea of what kind of things will happen in such complex evolutionary processes. And what I've sort of learned from that, if anything, is that it's totally unpredictable. All right? So that if you add, you know, you have some system where you think you understand it, and you add sort of one detail that leads now to some spatial organization or structure or things that actually feeds back on the selection and so on and so on, and then something may evolve off in a different direction than you had had predicted. I remember in Pauline's group, there was some sort of, we had almost like a game where somebody would have a new system and then in the group meeting show it, and then was sort of like guessing in advance what would happen, you know, which kind of strategy would actually win. And typically people would do horrible in predicting that, because there was always some sort of subtle pattern that evolved that you might not have. All right. So this is sort of what has shaped my thinking about this, and I'm sort of worried that no matter how much progress you make going from this sort of bottom up, where you want to get is always still very, very far away from where you are, and you don't really know what kind of simplifications are allowed. So of course, one thing that you can do is sort of ignore this problem. And there are many, many people, I think, in that do analysis of sequencing data and so on that infer, you know, what things are on the selection or what things have been, you know, adapted in your population, that simply say, well, I take the best model that I know and I simply force the data into that model. I'm just going to apply that model to the data and what it says, that's what I believe. And the other thing that you could do, and this is something that sort of we've seen a lot of talks about this, is to focus on evolution in the lab. So I think this is very, very nice. So you can set up systems in the lab that you understand enough that you have some idea of what kind of theory applies to those systems, and then you can try to understand it. So I think this is really nice. But I'm also not entirely sure how much this has to do with evolution in the real world. So whether and we were discussing this last night already, right? So whether these deleterious mutations in the LACI transcription factor binding site that might have a certain effect on growth rate in the lab, but what is that, how E. coli, why E. coli is keeping LACI binding site in the wild, that's a totally different question in principle. All right, and so then to be most provocative, right, so I mean, When I think about the fact that all evolutionary theory is often built around this central concept of fitness, which if you think about it, is essentially totally unmeasurable for systems in the real world, then I somehow sometimes think, well, isn't this totally crazy? Isn't it totally crazy to try and build a theory up around the concept this is essentially unmeasurable, all right? Maybe it would be a good idea to start from something you can measure instead of something that you cannot measure. Okay, so this is. All right, so now, and the thing is that we can measure lots of things, right? So when Darwin was around in early population genetics, there wasn't really anything, there wasn't really any data to use, right? And Darwin didn't even know what the genetic substrate is, right? And then for a long time, you know, DNA was only discovered in the structure of DNA was only discovered in the 50s, right? So for a long time, people simply didn't have data to do these things. So it's excusable, I think, that you say, well, I start with some abstract theoretical models. But nowadays, we do have lots and lots, you know, molecular biology has given us lots and lots of information. So we know all organisms store all their genetic information, plus or minus epsilon, into the DNA. Right, it's a one-dimensional string over a four-letter alphabet. That's also great for people like computer scientists and so on. It's a very nice, simple representation. We know about how genetic variations are introduced, mutations, recombination, so on. We know that DNA is transcribed into mRNA, and this mRNA is translated into proteins, and this is basically a universal genetic code. We know about that too, right? So we can actually take DNA and read it, and find out where are the genes and what are the amino acid sequences that these genes code for. And actually, and I think this is one of the great successes of computational biology and bioinformatics, is that there's all kinds of models, probabilistic models that you have now, that by just looking at the amino acid sequences and comparing it with the amino acid sequences of proteins that you know what they do, you can actually get some rough functional annotation for about 75% of all genes in microbial genomes, right? So if you go in the database and you go to some microbial genome, it will tell you for many, many, many of these genes what this gene does, even though nobody has ever done any experiment, right? This is all based on a sort of bioinformatic analysis. All right. So moreover, we have the entire genomes, right? So we have the entire genetic information, not just part of it, but everything, for a very fast increasing number of genomes, right? So the first whole genome is in 96, and so this I just downloaded the other day, again, from the microbial genome. So now it's, I mean, it's 1,400 whole microbial genomes. This is growing up exponentially. Daniel Fisher the other week showed that, you know, this increase of the amount of sequence data is even faster than Moore's law in computer science, right? So the amount of data is increasing faster than the speed with which computers can process this. All right, so what I want to sort of make a case for is to say, instead of starting at the bottom and trying to work your way up towards the complexity of the real world, then an alternative is to say, well, actually, we have all these genomes and we have a lot of background information coming from molecular biology. Can we just take an unbiased look at what's in these genomes and what seems to be happening to them during evolution and try to maybe just start looking for some macroscopic phenomenological laws about what these things are doing, and then maybe try to work your way back to the microscopic from the macroscopic end. So I just want to point out that this is an alternative route that you can take, and something that I'm trying to do.
You say alternative because you don't require a model a priori.
Right.
To look at data.
Yes.
It comes sort of later.
So I mean, I'm sort of thinking about this, you know, maybe evolution is sort of in this Carnot state of thermodynamics, right? So first, you know, you say I'm interested in understanding these heat engines, how they behave, and then first people discovered some sort of phenomenological laws and phenomenological macroscopic parameters and how they relate to each other, and only much, much, much later was this related to microscopic, and maybe something like this could happen in for evolution as well. So I just want to mention a couple of these sort of macroscopic phenomenological patterns that people have observed when they look at genome data, and that I think give us quite some interesting information about what are actually maybe important quantities that are being manipulated in genome evolution. So this is some, so this is not by me, so much of this work is not by me. So one of the things you can do is you can take two related organisms. So here in this example, Saccharomyces cerevisiae and Saccharomyces bayanos, those are two fungi. They had a common ancestor about 20 million years ago. And then for every gene that you find, for almost every gene that you find in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, you'll find an autologous gene that is a similar gene in Saccharomyces bayanos. And with autologous, it means that those two genes derive by common descent from a gene that already existed in the common ancestor of bayanos and cerevisiae. And then you can align those two genes with each other, and you can simply count at how many positions have substitutions taken place, right? So how many changes have happened since these two diverged from a common ancestor? And you can do this separately for those that change the amino acid and those that do not change the amino acid. And if you do that, you see that there is actually quite a wide distribution of the rate of substitutions, right? So different pairs of orthologs seem to evolving at very, very different rates. If you were to assume that everybody evolves at the same rate and that all variation is just fluctuation, sampling fluctuations, right, due to Poisson noise, then this is the distribution you would get, right? So the point is the distribution is much, much wider, right? So there are some genes that go very fast, there are some genes that go very slow, and over a much bigger range of scales, right, so this protein acting one is one in 1,000 changes per site, and this guy has 0.42 changes outside. So there's more than three orders of magnitude variation in this number. And there's even, for synonymous changes that are sort of mostly neutral, right? Not totally, but you see that there is much more variation than Poisson would tell you. And then, so here's some work. This is from Eugene Koonin's group. I think he's still coming, so maybe we'll talk about this. So if you do this for different pairs of organisms, and you normalize this by setting basically the mean to one, right? Then you see that actually these shapes of these distributions are fairly similar. They look sort of approximately log normal, and their variation is actually is quite similar, right? So the range that you get relative to the mean, the scale is quite similar. So this is Drosophila, Homo sapiens, this is Salmonella, and so on, right? So these are very, very different kinds of organisms. So it says there's a very wide range of evolutionary rates, and relative to the mean rate, the sort of the scale over which these rates varies are very, very similar across different organisms, right? So naturally, many people have asked, okay, what predicts whether a protein is on, or whether a gene is on this side, or whether it's on that side? And it's been remarkably difficult to find something that correlates very well with being slow or being fast. So the best correlation, to my knowledge, that has been found is shown here. So you can see it's not a very good correlation, right? But there is a clear correlation. And this says that, so this is some work by Alan Drummond and Klaus Winke. By the way, this picture Alan also gave me. You see that there is a negative correlation between the rate of evolution and the expression of the gene. So highly expressed genes tend to go slow, and low expressed genes tend to go fast. And so they have an explanation for this that I think is quite reasonable, which says that actually, and there was a discussion about this last week, but I also, my understanding is that the ribosome is actually quite error prone. So there is quite a number of misincorporations. And so there is a relatively large, the fraction of proteins that are made that have misincorporated amino acids in them is not very small. And so not unfrequently, this may actually destabilize the folding of the protein. Right, so if you put the wrong amino acid in some crucial place, the protein may no longer fold. And that this is actually putting a strong selection pressure on proteins. And clearly, this is going to be much more important pressure when you're high expressed, right? Because a high expressed guy, if you make 10% proteins that don't fold, that's a much larger number of proteins than you waste than with a low expressed guy. And so these highly expressed proteins, they're really optimizing their amino acid sequence and their codon bias to minimize the rate of errors and to be maximally robust against misincorporations. That even if you change some amino acids, even if you make some errors, it'll still fold in the right.
So how do they explain for the synonymous mutation such a broad distribution?
Because the different codons have different rates of errors associated with them. So that a highly expressed gene would have a much stronger codon bias to use only the good codons that are unlikely to make
right,
an error.
Right. So why doesn't it just evolve to using the best codons?
Well, this okay. So this there's another discussion yesterday. But there is always evolution. There's always a trade-off, right? Why don't we all become Superman, right? I mean, there is a trade-off between how strong the selective pressure is and mutations introducing suboptimal ones. So a mutation that only increases the rate of errors by a small amount may still have a reasonable chance of fixing, right? So there is always a balance between these things.
Also, a talk by Nico Bitterai last week, he exactly proposed the reason why sometimes genomes keep those suboptimal codons, because to minimize traffic jams, for instance, of ribosomes. Right. So there.
Yes. So that, I mean, okay. So whether this is there is lots more going on, right? And so this talk last week showed that there might be, you know, you might want to avoid traffic jams, and so there might be all kinds of other things, right? Maybe the RNA also folds, right? So you change codons, it may change the folding of the RNA. Of course, there's always selection happening on many, many levels.
But just to make sure, this is not, even if you take this into account, you will still have the residual widths of the distribution of both synonymous and non-synonymous rates broader than what you would expect in a Poisson null model. So this is the strongest correlation, but that's not everything.
Yes, and I know that, so Eugene's group has some evidence also that certain protein structures are just inherently more stable than others. So certain protein structures allow for lots and lots of substitutions and they will still fold. Whereas other ones, they're very finicky. right? And so this is another variable that might add some, explain some of this, this variation.
Probably all the guys knew it for ages, because ultimately delta G is some determinant of stability. Each mutation changes delta G by, Eugen Chafnovich was giving this talk about how delta G evolves in response to mutations. So if you have an intrinsically stable protein with large delta G, it will take many mutations to destabilize it.
Yes.
Is there a correlation between the between DN and DS?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
For instance, via the level, because they're both related.
I have to watch out. This is not my work, right? So I'm not intimately familiar with. So if you, there's many things you can ask me that I won't know the answer to. I'm just pointing it out as, I think, an interesting observation, and it'll teach you something about pressures that exist in evolution that I think you would never have learned from a bottom-up way. I guess it's extremely unlikely that you would have sort of predicted
it. I mean, one can immediately imagine that there is selection which prodents the non-synonymous mutations, and that drives also the prodening of the synonymous mutation.
Yes. Yes, I agree.
And it's probably also fair to say that people start to discover that the bare neutral mutation rate is not really important.
Yes.
These some estimates, the dashed line, are produced with a unit, assuming a unit.
Yeah, but I don't think that is really going to buy you a lot of extra variation. It'll buy you some, but I mean, they don't change by three orders of magnitude, the bare mutation rates, I think.
No.
All right, so shall I go on?
Data on mRNA stability? Do you know more data?
Yeah. I actually worked on that when I was still at Rockefeller for human. And then we tried to see what this correlates with, and to see if you find stuff in the sequence motifs that are sort of predictive or slow. And we didn't find much. Or, you know, you find some things. But it's, for instance, clear that things like transcription factors, they turn over very fast. So actually, the most predictive for half-life that we found was the function of the gene. So if a gene like a transcription factor, they tend to turn over fast, whereas some structural genes, they're very slow on average. All right. Okay. So here's another example that I heard about actually at this summer school that Jonathan organized last year. So this is work from Nancy Moran and Howard Ockman's groups. And I just want to show it because I thought it was interesting. So what they looked at is they looked again at pairs of bacteria, and for each pair of bacteria, they measured the genome size, right? So what is the these are bacteria that have the pairs have the two members of the pair have very similar size, but the different pairs of different sizes of genome. And then they simply measured the ratio, right? So you can look at the non-synonymous rate and the synonymous rate. So they look at the ratio of the non-synonymous rate relative to the synonymous rate for these different pairs of genomes, and they find that this is very noisy, right? This is biology, but there is clearly, I would say, a negative correlation, right? So that the genomes that are small, they tend to have a higher ratio Ka, Ks than the genomes that are large. And so their argument is that this Ka, Ks, so they say that most substitutions are probably either neutral or slightly deleterious. And if you basically make this assumption, then the Ka-Ks ratio says something about the strength of purifying selection. So if purifying selection is very, very strong, then this Ka-Ks ratio would be low. And if purifying selection is weak, then this Ka-Ks ratio would be bigger. Right? So they actually say that you can think of Ka-Ks as a measure of effective population size. Alright, so now, okay, I don't know if this you can really make this, but this is what sort of what they'd like to argue. They say if Ka-Ks is very large, that means small effective population size. If it's big, then it's large effective population size. And so they would like to claim and interpret this as saying that there is a negative correlation between effective population size, a positive correlation between effective population size and genome size in bacteria. And I'm putting this out because this is going totally in the opposite direction of the argument of Lynch, right? Which says small population size, big genomes, right? So why is that? Well, because I think there is somewhere a hidden assumption here that says that unless you're selecting, your genome is withering away. And in bacteria, there's some evidence for that, that if things are not under selection, they're sort of being pulled out. And then under the Lynch model, I think the sort of implicit assumption is in those genomes, unless you're selecting against it, things will grow, right? All right, so here's another one that I think is interesting. So this is a paper from a paper of Graham Mitchison from 2005, where he looked at the simple base composition of genomes. So how many A, C's, G's, and T's, right? And so he looked at AT content, and what he noticed is that if you look at different regions in bacterial genomes, so you can look in coding regions, so this is the red dots, or in three types of intergenic regions, right? So in bacteria, because each gene can be on the positive or the negative strands, the intergenic regions between two operons, there are three types of them. There's one type that is downstream of two genes. So presumably that this intergenic region is not regulating the expression of any gene. Then it can be upstream of one operon and downstream of another one, where this intergenic region would regulate only this operon, or you can have a divergently transcribed pair, in which case this would regulate two genes. And basically he found that across different bacteria, there are very different AT content, right? So it goes from something like 25% to like 80% AT content. And that across this range, you always find that the lowest AT content is encoding, then in these A regions, then in B regions, and then in C regions. Of course, there are exceptions, but that's the general rule, all right? So coding is the most GC rich, then these downstream regions, then regions upstream of one gene, and then regions upstream of two genes, right? And his argument, and I'm not quite sure if I'm totally convinced by that, is that basically those intergenic regions that need more transcription factor binding site tend to become more AT-rich because transcription factor binding sites, on average, are more AT-rich than the rest of the genome. All right?
Those intergenic regions altogether, they comprise, you know, under 10% of the genome. So even if you get rid of all the intergenic regions altogether, just keep the coding sequences.
Yes.
You'll still have a huge variability in GC context about what they're in.
Yes.
From. So it's all this. What is going on in between in intergenic regions is a minor correction to the overall
yes.
GC bias due to
right. The observation is that correction always goes in the same direction.
I see.
Always goes to more AT. All right. And so, so that might be an explanation for why intergenic regions have more AT than the coding, which is the bulk, as Sergey points out. But it doesn't still explain why is there so much variation in GC content of the bulk. Right? So we were discussing the other day, so I just made this picture a couple days ago, where on the every dot here is a completely sequenced genome. On the x-axis is the genome size in megabase. And on the y-axis is the percentage of that genome's GC content. Right? And so what you see, well, again, it's very noisy, but I do think that it is clearly a pattern. If you know, you can do regression, and it will tell you it's extremely significant and so on, right? But I mean, if you just look at it, you see if your genomes that are less than 1.5 megabase tend to be mostly AT-rich, whereas genomes that are big, they tend to be mostly GC-rich, right? So there is a general correlation, positively, between GC content and genome size. And I don't think that this has been explained at all, because all sort of analysis of mutational patterns, so either by in vitro experiment or by looking at what happens in pseudogenes, So these are genes that have become incapacitated in bacterial genomes, and then you can compare them against them. They all suggest that the mutational mechanism itself is biased from GC to AT. All right? And there are also several arguments that have been put forward by people like Eduardo Rocha and so on that say that there are reasons why you would like high AT content, that ATs are cheaper to make, for example, metabolically than GCs, so that there might be, especially in small pathogens on this side, some pressure to be high AT. But that doesn't explain, as far as I can tell, why are these guys that have these very, very high GC content, and why would that scale with genome size and so on.
This is bacterial genome, so there's no nucleosome or anything like
that. No, nothing.
There's also something about parasites, right? They have higher GC or lower?
Right, so it might be, so the parasites are mostly small genomes, right? So you could, one thing that you could say is that the GC content is like a status symbol, right? So if you're a big genome, you have a big GC content, and you can recognize one of these pathogens' high AT content and maybe silence its DNA that it doesn't interfere with you, right? There's some
more like a gated community of GC rich.
Right, right. But the other thing you could say, if it's really true that the tryptophan factor binding sites are, let's say, AT rich, right? Maybe in big genomes there's more of an issue of transcription factors binding all over the places where you don't want them, and so maybe you want to be more GC rich to avoid them going into your coding regions.
Very strong effect, right? It's from 20% to 70%.
Right. No, that's the thing, right? It's not like from 45% to 55%, right? There's a very big range, and it correlates with genome size, and there's absolutely no explanation as far as I can tell.
Could there be a relation also with effective population size here? It would go counter to what Ockman apparently found, that large genomes have small effective population sizes. But here,
No. He says, Ockman and Moran say, in bacteria, large population size, large genome. So that would say there is some benefit to having GCs.
AT bias in mutation, and it could be that large populations with large genomes, which occur in large populations,
yes,
are more effective.
But what's the benefit of having lots of GCs? That's not clear.
But if there is a
mutation,
just selecting
against mutations, which would drive them towards AT.
You're saying GCs are on an absolute level less mutable. I don't know if that's true, actually. But it's interesting suggestion.
The purifying effects of selection are stronger.
So the mutation bias is to AT.
Yeah.
So let's say that a 50% GC would be the best. So these small guys don't have a chance of getting rid of these ATs that mutation keeps producing. So they accumulate ATs.
Right, but then you would never get more than 50%, right?
Yeah.
Right, that's true.
Okay.
If you look at other groups, don't you see different kinds of biases? I don't really remember this, but I thought plants were more AT biased, right? And so when you take bacterial genes and you put them into plants, so I'm thinking, 10, 20 years ago, when this transgenesis was just starting, you take the bacterial genes and you try to put it into a plant, they had to go in and doctor the GC counts and not really expressed well enough. So I think that they're quite different, and I don't know how in plants it would scale the genome size, but I wonder if there's any consistency to this across groups.
But not, all right, so I have no idea. But of course, this plot shows free living, obligate parasites, hosts, or anything, right? This is all sequenced genomes. So these are not just guys that live in sort of eukaryotic hosts, right? It could also be. You're right, they're just bacteria. All right, so this is, as many of you know, so this is some of my own work on these kind of looking for these large-scale patterns. So I try to make use of the fact that there are these bioinformatic methods for assigning at least a rough functional annotation to most genes in the genome. And so then what you can ask is, across different sequence bacterial genomes, what is the numbers of genes in different functional categories, right? So then the observation is, which I still think is quite surprising, is that there are pretty clean parallel relationships between the total size of the genome and the number of genes in different functional categories, right? So here on the x-axis is the total number of genes in the genome. Every dot is a genome. On the y-axis is, in red, how many transcription factors are in these different genomes. In green is how many cell cycle genes, and in blue are how many metabolic genes. And so what you see is, so this is log-log scale, is that these dots fall on roughly straight lines, which means that the number of genes, NC is the number of genes in some functional category, G grows as some power law with some exponent alpha C of the total number of genes in the genome, N. And these exponents, they vary quite a bit, right? So for transcription regulation, this slope is around 1.9 somewhere. Metabolism, this is roughly linear. In cell cycle, is roughly 1/2, right? So this says the number of cell cycle genes grows roughly linear with genome size. Every time you double the genome, you get twice as many metabolic genes. But the number of transcription factors is going up almost quadratically. Every time you double the size of your genome, you get four times as many transcription factors. And for cell cycle genes, it's the other way around, right? So it's roughly square root. So you have to quadruple the size of your genome to get two times as many cell cycle genes. And so this is not just true for those couple of categories that I just showed you. In general, if you just, so there are these, there are now the bioinformatics community has defined these sort of hierarchies of functional categories for annotating gene function. And so if you just take, let's say, all categories that are represented by at least one gene in 90% of all genomes, then so those are sort of high-level ubiquitous thing that almost everybody has, then for the large majority of these categories, that you find a good power law fit. All right, so this is, these power laws are very common for high-level functional categories. And there also seems to be some general rules about which kind of categories grow fast, have a big exponent, and which ones have a low exponent. So I don't know how well you could see this, but here's a couple of categories. That I've shown here what is the exponent within the red, the error bar on the exponent. And so you see that for sort of very basic processes that all organisms have to do, like translate mRNA into proteins, replicate the DNA, process the RNA, these all have very, very low slopes, right? So the number of genes in these categories grows only very, very slowly with genome size. Especially like the sort of translation machinery, it's almost fixed. Even if, you know, you have a certain number of genes, a reasonably big number of genes that are involved in this, but that number is hardly increasing at all as you go to bigger genomes. And then very sort of metabolic processes that have to do with, you know, eating various kinds of food and so on, the numbers of genes in those categories is going roughly linearly up with genome size. And then superlinearly, you find there are things involved in regulation. So signal transduction and transcription factor activity, those things go roughly quadratically with genome size. So the regulatory stuff is growing faster.
Genome size, you mean number of genes?
Yes. I will show you later in bacteria, that's really almost the same as saying genome size.
So, I mean, if the number of transcription factors goes like the square,
yeah,
there must be some size.
Yes.
So what's that size? Are you very far from it?
Yeah, so you're about the factor. So that size would be 35,000. And the biggest bug that I know has 12 or something.
It seems never to go above 10%. The fraction of bureaucratic overhead doesn't exceed 10%.
Right.
Neither bacteria nor eukaryotes.
Yes.
But if you extrapolate, then at some genome size you reach 100%.
Right. So I believe, I'll say one or two more things later about this, that this sort of overhead, the regulatory overhead, might be actually something that sort of caps the genome size in bacteria. But I don't think that we understand it well enough that we can actually predict what is sort of quantitatively the largest bacteria. Right. All right. So one thing that we've been doing and that I want to go over very quickly is to try and say, what can we now, given these scaling laws that we observe, what can we infer about the evolutionary dynamics of, say, gene content, say, the gain and loss through evolutionary times of genes and genomes? And to do this, I think it was actually beneficial to, instead of focus on genes, to focus at a sort of a lower level of functional organization, namely on protein domains. And so, okay, so this is biology, so everything never always 100% applies, right? But I think, to a reasonable approximation, protein domains are functional units in the sense that they're a piece of a protein that can do something by itself. And they're structural units in the sense that you can take that piece of amino acid sequence and it'll fall by itself into the structure. And you cannot split it into smaller functional units, right? So it's atomic in the sense that you cannot take two halves of a domain and have them do something useful, right? So this is sort of always, to some extent, fuzzy, but I think protein structure people have found out that there really does seem to be some sort of structural units, these domains that fold by themselves and have some own function. And what is really, really great is that there are now very large collections of these protein domain families that have been discovered. And people have made multiple alignments of all the sequences in the database of amino acids, sequences that fold into the same protein domain, and they made multiple alignments of these, and then from these multiple alignments made probabilistic hidden Markov models that you can now use to discover new members of this family in sequence genomes. So this is actually how this functional annotation is done. The way that this functional annotation is done is you take your genome, you first predict where all the genes are, then you translate them into amino acid sequences, and then you come with your 10,000 hidden Markov models, and you scan all these hidden Markov models over all these sequences and look for hits, right? And the nice thing is, I mean, this is also something that's important to realize, is that structure evolves much slower than sequence, right? So you can have sequences that are so far apart that no algorithm would detect any significant similarity between them, but they both fold into the exact same structure, or very, very similar structure. And once you've made a probabilistic model of the entire family of sequences that fold into the structure, you can recognize that both these guys fold into the structure, even though you wouldn't recognize it by pairwise comparison. All right? So I think these models are very, very useful for looking at these sort of like functional atoms in genomes. And the other thing that is nice is that if you take a genome and you find for this particular family out of this set of 10,000 families, there are 5 copies, right, of this family in the genome. And a closely related bacterium has 4 copies, then you can be fairly sure that either this one guy gained one copy or this other guy lost one copy, right? Because those things don't, the chance that they just emerge out of nowhere by chance is just very, very, so much smaller than the chance that some was duplicated or taken up from another bug that you can forget about this. All right, so we took this as the units of study, and then we first wanted to check that these scaling laws also applies when we count domains instead of genes, right? So this is now data that is somewhat less old. So every dot again is a genome, and so here are 3 categories, and you see that the number of transcription factors is still growing almost quadratically with genome size. Metabolic, this is slightly less than linear, and translation is almost flat. Right? So you find these scaling laws also at the level of domain. So then we ask, okay, so what is the minimal model, evolutionary model, for how the domain content of genomes evolves that can explain these scaling laws? So this is a project that this PhD student, Nacho Molina, worked on. And so I just, you know, many of you have heard this before, so I'll just summarize very quickly. So if you make one, so you say, first of all, I've observed the scaling laws, so somehow these scaling laws have to apply. And number 2, I'm going to assume that these scaling laws are time invariant. That is, if I were to go back, if I could go back 10 or 50 or 100 million years, and I collect bacterial genomes, then, and I make the same plots, I get the same scaling laws. All right? So if you assume time invariance, then it basically means that as a genome is evolving, it keeps obeying these scaling laws. And so, so this was the scaling law we had, right? So the log of the number of genes in a category is a linear function of the log of the total number of genes. And now assume that over some small period of time, this NC evolves into NC plus delta NC. So there is some change in the number of domains in this category. And there is also so some change in the total number of genes, but I want these new numbers to obey the same scaling law. All right? So this is the time invariance postulate. Then if these DNs are small relative to N, right, this is roughly this, so this is DNC over NC, and this has to be equal to alpha C, the exponent, DN over N. So I can now move this NC to this side, so I get this. All right? So what this says is if you look over a small period of time, and the total number of genes in the genome changes by DN, then the total change of the number of genes in category C should be actually NC over N. So that's actually the fraction of all domains in the genome that belong to category C. So the change is proportional to this fraction, and it's proportional to the scaling exponent. All right? So it says that as you're changing the either growing or shrinking your genome by a bit, the change in the numbers of genes in a particular category is proportional to the number you already had in this category times the scaling exponent. All right. So then, what does that mean in the limit of very small time? Right. So, I mean, I'm writing dn, but of course there's no such thing as an infinitesimal change in the number of domains. So the smallest change you can have is plus or minus one. Right. So if dn is plus or minus one, you're either adding or removing one domain. And then what this says is the change in the number of domains in the category when dn is, let's say, plus or minus one is the fraction of domains that belong to this category times alpha c. So the way I'd like to interpret this is saying when I add one gene to my genome, the probability that this will be a gene in category c is given by this expression here. And the same when I remove it, right, when I remove one gene from the genome, it's exactly the same probability that tells me that it would be a domain from this category. Right, so that is what this picture shows. So this is time t. So here are all the domains in your genome. Different colors indicate different functional categories. Now I'm adding one domain to my genome, and so the probability that I'm going to that domain will be green is simply given by what is the fraction of green among all domains times the scaling exponent of the category green. And the same when I remove one, right? So when I'm going to remove one of these domains, the probability that it will be a green domain is simply what fraction of all domains is green times the scaling exponent. Right? So sort of these scaling exponents say by how much the amount of events that involve genes or domains in category C is enhanced or suppressed over what you would expect by chance. Right? So because if you just randomly duplicated or deleted the genes, then you would still get that the probability that you hit one in a certain category is proportional to the fraction of all domains in that category. But now this says this number is either enhanced over that expectation or suppressed over that expectation by precisely the scaling exponent.
And how do you guarantee that this probability is less than 1 if alpha can be larger than 1, can be close to 2, by the way?
Yes.
Sorry for the question.
It's purely phenomenological for me here, right?
Yes.
In a way that you
and
have no...
Matter, you don't have control about LC over N because they are fluctuating quantities.
Yes.
And alpha is fixed from the beginning,
yes.
So...
Yes.
One question.
question. So
yeah, why don't you answer that?
No, I just you're talking about domains and genes, but when you delete the gene, you delete.
No, it's always genes. When I say gene, I meant to say domain.
Okay. So, but then not all not all the domains can interact with each other, right? So there are some rules of domain interaction and coexistence somehow. So when you delete a coding gene, which consists of several domains.
Yes.
So there are constraints. And then since they are interchangeable in your scaling nodes, it means that the number of constraints are somehow equal to the number of genes that you are seeing. Otherwise, you would have seen the combinatorial.
But I agree with you that there's all kinds of dependencies and so on that we're not trying to model at all. But there are also dependencies between genes, right? It's not just that there are dependencies between domains. There are also dependencies between genes, and they come in operons and maybe, you know, pathways and so on. So this problem happens at all scales, right?
How many domains normally, on average, one gene have? One coding?
Well, that varies. But I mean, I would say one, two, three, to a handful. And of course, we don't know all domains that exist. Right, so it might have three, but we only detect one because the other ones we don't have a model for yet.
Okay, so if there's one to two, then somehow.
Yeah, so it's not the 100.
Okay, it's not that the combinatorial effect is sort of dominant.
All right, so to come, I mean.
Can you restate the question?
The question, so she rightly points out that, you know, domains, they come together in a gene, right? And so when you're deleting something, you tend to delete a whole chunk at once. And in those chunks, you have multiple domains sitting there. And they're not some random collection of domains, because certain domains come together often in genes and other domains will not come together often. Right? So there is this whole statistics that is, you're not really adding and removing independently domains. Which I agree, but it's sort of like mean fields, right? We're sort of ignoring that. So your question is something that I actually have worried about a lot, and to try to understand, because there is something really sort of a little bit screwy about this, right? And it says that somehow this alpha is not a fixed rate for a domain, but it's fixed relative to the average of all the other guys in the genome. All right? Because as you get to bigger genomes, right, the fraction of transcription factors goes up. So the average sort of alpha of the guys in your genome is also going up. Or the average scaling exponent. But it still says that on average, transcription factors are twice as likely to be hit relative to all other guys in the genome, even though they're now a bigger subset of the genome.
Aren't you constraining yourself a little too much just by saying that, if you like, sort of pure kinematics, it's just a matter of duplication? Can I think of this instead as some sort of a branching process where I duplicate the domain, or delete the domain, duplicate the domain, duplicate it again, delete it, and so on?
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, when I duplicate the domain, what is the probability that I will keep the duplicate?
Mm-hmm.
That is, the offspring will survive and flourish with the duplicate. As opposed to when I delete the domain, I'm still alive. And then you get some additional numbers, the ratio of which I think you can pretty much tweak to get anything you want. But you know, presumably, you know, we may not know the relevant ratios, but you can imagine it in principle.
So there is many different ways that you could set this up, right? So. We can assume that this comes from the fact that duplications and deletions that are introduced into the population happen at this rate, and then this somehow reflects what is selection doing, right? And you can try to write this in various ways. But, you know, because I don't want to bore people who have already heard these sort of arguments once or twice before, right? I'm sort of trying to sort of cook it down to what I think is the crucial thing, and that is somehow the chance that this extra domain will be fixed in the population somehow has to be proportional to this, has to be enhanced by a factor alpha over what it would be if everybody had the same genes.
Just one last comment before you delve into deep mathematics. It's convenient to think about it as the application events, because then you have at least some rationale for explaining why the null model would have this alpha equal to 1. In other words, if it's the application and you have a certain subset of genes which could be duplicated, then the chances that it will be hit by a duplication event are proportional to its fraction in the genome. But what the body of evidence we have about bacterial evolution is that
I'll come to that. All right. So then, what we decided to do is if you have closely related pairs of genomes, you can sort of test this prediction, right? So if this is the tree of life, then you imagine that we're looking at pairs of genomes that are quite close to each other, so that the number of events that have happened in those is close, right? And so. So during a short time interval, the fraction of all events, right, where an event is either you add a gene or you remove a gene of the genome, that involve domains in category C is given by what is the fraction in the current genome of the domains that belong to category C times the scaling exponent. So then what we do for our pair of genomes, we first estimate what is the fraction in this pair of genomes, and since they're close, those two fractions are similar in the two genomes that belong to category C. So this is just the numbers of domains in these two genomes that belong to category C divided by the total numbers. And then by comparing these two genomes and looking at it one PFAM domain at a time, we estimate what is the total number of addition or deletion events that have taken place since these two genomes diverged from each other. And what is the total number of such events that involve domains in category C, right? So we estimate these two numbers, and then we can take the ratio and say, so this F delta C, so this is an observed quantity for these two genomes, that is the fraction of all events that took place since they diverged from a common ancestor that involve domains in category C. And the prediction is that this fraction delta is equal to what is the fraction of all domains in these genomes that are category C times alpha C. All right? So that's what the model predicts. So then we could check this. So here every blue dot is a category. On the x-axis, I've shown you here what is the scaling exponent of that category. That is to say, if you make a plot of all bacterial genomes, genome size against the number of domains in this category, this is the slope of the exponent that you fit. And here on the y-axis, I said, when I take these pairs of closely related genomes and I ask what fraction of all addition or deletion events involve guys in this category, this is F delta, divided by what is the fraction of domains in this category in the genome, that ratio, which we call evolutionary potential, is given here on the y-axis. And the theory says those two should be equal. And well, we don't find that they're equal, but they're pretty well correlated. All right? So there's a good linear correlation between the exponent of the category and this relative rate of additions and deletions that evolve domains of this category, right? And so I think this is actually quite a non-trivial observation, right? Because this exponent here says something about how is the number of domains in this category scaling as you go from small genomes to big genomes. So it's a sort of a static thing. Whereas this is a dynamic thing. As I say, I look at pairs of closely related genomes, I estimate how many domain addition and deletion events were there, and what is the fraction of those domain deletion events that involves category this category. All right, So these scaling exponents correlates well with evolutionary potential. So this basically this is a sort of a null model of domain evolution that says that the relative rates at which you're adding and deleting domains in different functional categories is proportional to the scaling exponent of scaling. So this makes these scaling exponents as sort of like a fundamental quantities that are observed by the evolutionary process. Okay.
You derive, so it should be equal to alpha C.
Right.
And that just followed from this one postulate of time invariant.
Yes.
You can't really, and that was all you assumed.
Yes.
Now, does this mean that the time invariance is not strict, does not strictly hold, apparently? And can you sort of fix that by assuming they slowly change in one or two directions?
Well, it can mean many things, so we've wondered about this too. Why don't we get a slope of one, right? Because, I mean, that's really what's wrong with this, right? The slope is less than one. And, well, you know, these things are all noisy estimates. So if we are sort of systematically underestimating the number of events for guys in the categories with high exponent, and we sort of try to take care that we don't do that, right? Because you would naturally do that, right? Because especially if you added one and then removed one and add one again, that's three moves, not one move. But it might look like one move. So we try to sort of correct for these things, but if we're not properly doing that, that can easily depress this. Another thing that we thought about is, if for closely related pairs, maybe there are sort of mutants around that selection hasn't really had the time to act on yet. Right? So you can imagine, if you go in the limit of time very, very, very close to one, right, then selection has no time to act. So you're really looking only at the mutational process. Then the numbers of domains, then these alphas would all be one, because there is no effect of selection. And that would also have this sort of effect of increasing the guys that you see at this end. So the guys that will be weeded out. So to test that, we checked of whether this becomes closer to one if we remove the closest pairs and leave only sort of pairs a little bit further apart, but that didn't really help.
But can you also integrate your model so that you not only look at infinitesimal time increments for which this prediction holds, but perhaps you look at closely related species, but you have to go back in time for a certain amount, which depends on the pair you're looking at. So it would be handy to have a model where this is a variable too.
Yeah, but it is not dependent on time, right? I mean, I mean, it's only dependent on time in the sense that if I take guys that are further and further away, it's harder for me to estimate what is the number of events that happened.
You only see a certain difference.
No, because if you had 12 addition events in this P family and 11 removals, it just looked like there's one more, and it's very hard for you to estimate that that's actually 23 events, right? So you can only reliably do this for closely related pairs of genomes. That's why we're focusing on those.
Does your model assume somehow that the mean genome size remains constant?
No.
Time, or could that grow?
No. It can do whatever you want. And this is, because it's very, thank you for asking that question, because that's one thing that this model says nothing about. It says nothing whatsoever about whether it grows or shrinks. It says when it grows, then you know you add things according to these ratios, and when it shrinks, you remove things according to these ratios. But it doesn't say what makes you grow or shrink. So I would say that is sort of the key variable where we have said nothing yet, and where I would like to learn more about. And this is also what now motivates the next part of what.
So it's compatible with sort of increasing complexity
yes.
along the way.
Yes.
So you might have said it, but when you compiled the data for the evolutionary potential, you took, I mean, obviously you don't know, you don't have a fixed delta T, right? So you're taking, you're comparing things that are just as close as you can find them, but they could actually...
Right, so Nacho had some rule, he said, you know, things that are so close that there are no changes, those are out.
Yeah.
So we need a minimal number of changes. And then, I think the sort of distance E. coli, Salmonella was the furthest we ever went out.
So that could introduce a skewness from...
Yes. Yeah, yeah, so we're trying to correct for this undercounting when there have been multiple addition and then deletion events. But, I mean, you know, never perfect. All right, well, let me go on. So this is Sergei's remark, which I'd like to call the horizontal transfer paradox. So if you read the literature on microbial genomics and so on, then you'll see that there is quite a number of recent studies that all suggest that actually most gene additions are the result of not duplicating your own gene, but taking up a gene from the environment, horizontal transfer, all right? And in my opinion, this introduces a little bit of a paradox, because we've seen that the rate of addition of domains of category C is proportional to this current count, NC, right? And for duplications, that is very natural, right? Because, like Boris pointed out, if you just have randomly genes duplicating, the rate with which this is happening is proportional to how many domains you already have in this category, because each of them can get duplicated, right? But if that's not the main mode in which you acquire new genes, if the main mode is taking them up from the environment, then there's no reason why it should be proportional to NC. But that is what we find in the data, all right? So I haven't shown you some of the more detailed data, but that is really what it looks like, that it's to a very good approximation, proportional to how you already have. So this, I would say, this is something that's in need of an explanation, and there are several things, yes?
But you have the same scaling across everybody, so if I think of horizontal transfer as just picking up a chunk of somebody's DNA,
yeah. Yeah, but that, okay, very good. That says, that requires that microbial niches are such that the guys around you tend to have roughly the same genome size as you. Because if you're a big guy, with most of the guys around you are small genomes, then they have much, much lower fraction of transcription factors than you have. So then this is certainly not true anymore.
What's the coherence of genome size along a phylogeny? Say, would it be sufficient to assume for you that you preferably take over genes from close relatives?
Right, so that could be another thing. There could be, so here, this is, mechanisms exist to prefer transfers between genomes with similar size. Right, so this is where is this G content status symbol, right? So maybe there are mechanisms that say, if the chunk that I'm receiving has very different GC content from me, I don't want it. All right, that is possible.
But horizontal transfers, as every evolutionary step is a complex process, you may actually pick up a lot of genes in one event and yes. Then get rid of all the things you don't need. And so what I'm trying to say is that even if you get stuff from either much larger genome or smaller genome in a one kind of evolutionary step, very soon you will adjust it to your own genome size because you need to somehow take into account function more than just assigning some coefficient like evolutionary potential to a function. So the function may take care of this apparent paradox.
All right, but that is not obvious that it will. So this motivates, so the one theoretical project that is ongoing that I want to talk to you about a bit is what is the distribution of genome sizes in different environments? We'd like to know, are these very broadly distributed, or do you find that in different environments you have very narrowly distributed range of genome sizes? And basically, this is based on the following observation, is that if these scaling laws apply universally, then you can actually use the scaling laws together with metagenomic data to infer the moments of the distribution of genome sizes, right? So imagine that PG is the fraction of all organisms in a given environment that have genome size G. And let FC be the fraction of all genes in the environment that belong to the category C, right? So you imagine that you grind up all DNA of all organisms in the environment and say, what fraction of the DNA that I have now comes from genes in category C? All right, that fraction is actually easily measurable using metagenomic data, right? Because what metagenomics does is you just fish random DNA from your environment and you sequence it, and if we can then functionally annotate that DNA, we can say what fraction of the DNA in this environment is coming from transcription factors, right? So that's FC. So now what is FC, right? So I can write FC as the ratio between all genes in the environment from category C divided by the total amount of genes in the environment, right? So this is the fraction of genomes that are size G times genome size, summed over all possible genome sizes, that is the average genome size in the environment. This is the number of genes in category C multiplied by this. So this is the average number of genes in category C in the environment. So this ratio is equal to this. But I know that this obeys the scaling law, right? So the number of genes in category C for a genome of size G is G to the alpha C times this prefactor to the beta C. So now if I take this sum here, this is precisely the alpha C moment of the distribution of genome sizes in this environment. All right? So if I measure these fractions for different categories with different exponents, I basically get different moments of the distribution of genome sizes. And so in principle, I can infer a lot about the distribution of genome sizes in an environment from measurement of these fractions. So the first question is, are these scaling laws really universal? All right, so that's one more thing that Nacho worked on. Because now there's so much data that you can say, let's just take only the bacteria from clade X and build a scaling law from this clade. Do you really get the same scaling law for all clades? So I don't really want to go into the details how we did this, but the answer is, so this is in this Transcription Genetics paper, but the answer is for most categories, yes. So for categories like metabolic process, regulation of transcription, the variation that you see in the scaling law when you use different clades is actually so small that it might just be fluctuation, right? But you can't really strongly reject the hypothesis that this is all just statistical fluctuations, but there are some categories where this is not the case. So one example is amino acid metabolism. So if you look at bacilli here, or you look at cyanobacteria, these guys really show very different exponents for that scaling law. All right? So there are some categories, but it's like less than 10% of the ones we studied, where there seems to be a clear dependence on what clade or lifestyle of bacteria you look at. But for the large majority of them, they do look universal. All right. So this project, this is done by Federico Squartini. So we picked a set of categories that have nice tight scaling laws. Right, so they have nice tight scatters when you look at them. We don't see significant variations in these scaling laws across clades, so we believe that for those categories they're pretty much universal, and they have different exponents ranging from close to 0 to 2. So here's a set of examples of some of the categories we took. Right, so the ribosome, the exponent of this is very close to zero. RNA polymerase, also close to zero. Nucleotide metabolism is roughly square root. And then here on this end, these regulators, you get close to 2. Right? So there's this set of categories that we look at with different scaling exponents. And by measuring the fraction of genes from the environment belonging to each of these categories, we can estimate these moments of the distribution of genome sizes. All right. So you can simplify these equations a little bit by introducing, so this is what we had previously, right? So the fraction of genes in the environment belonging to category C is given in terms of this alpha C moment to the first moment in times this prefactor that's associated with this category. If you introduce a new distribution, so I call this P tilde, so X is now a logarithm of the genome size. All right, so instead of looking at genome size, I'm going to look at logarithm of genome sizes. And P tilde X is not what is the fraction of genome of individuals in the environment that are size X, but is what is the fraction of all the DNA in the environment that comes from genomes of size X. All right, it's just to simplify the mathematics a bit. So this is just given by P of genome size, which is e to the x, times genome size, e to the x, right? Because a large genome contributes more to the environment than a small genome. So that's this distribution T tilde of x. And then you can easily show that the fraction of genes in the environment belonging to category C is basically given by the expectation value of e to the x times the scaling exponent of this category minus 1. Right? But this is like a Laplace transform of the distribution of x. Right? This is really the Laplace transform evaluated at the point 1 minus alpha c. Right? So by measuring these fractions, right? So if I take this fraction and I move this to the other side, right? So to multiply it by e to the minus beta c, that I know because I know these scaling laws, these numbers actually give me points along the Laplace transform of the distribution of genome size in the environment. Sergei.
Just to clarify, when you're if you are dealing with metagenomics data where one species is dominant in terms of its copy numbers, just yes. There are a lot of those bugs in yes. The environment, you still count this one species as one point in your data point. In other words,
no.
You do not weigh by the
no, I
the
do.
Abundance.
I do weigh by abundance.
But then I'm just afraid that this, you know, since there are all those stories about metagenomic samples where, you know, 40% or 60% come from just one species, then in some sense you don't have enough range of genome sizes. You'll just have all your averages will be dominated by this one species, and therefore you will get a kind of.
But then that's the answer. If that's the answer, that's the answer.
We'll see that, right?
That's the answer. If it turns out that in most environments there is a dominant size.
So you do not beat the data in any way. You because some people, for instance, say,
how would I do that? I can't do it.
And they say whatever is wrong. Okay, so you don't.
No. Okay. So I could try to assemble, and then somehow collapse. You know, all the reads that we think came from the same genome, right? But okay. All right, so this is just to show how this works, right? So if I have this is synthetic, right? If I have a log normal distribution of the number of domains per genome, then this is what this Laplace transform would look like. So this is this exponent alpha, and this is this this Laplace transform. And so you see that if there is one dominant genome size, precisely as Sergei says, so that the distribution of genome size, this is log genome size, right? But this distribution is a delta function, then this Laplace transform is just an exponential where the slope of this exponential is simply this log genome size, right? Then you would have a straight line in this plot, okay? And when there is some variation, so if you take a log normal, right, so you take this distribution of genome sizes, then this Laplace transform has this exponential plus the a curvature that is proportional to the variance. All right, so it will be curved, positive curvature, and the curvature is in fact precisely the variation over Q. Right, so by looking at this, by looking at these plots, we should be able to get a sense of what is the characteristic genome size mu, and what is the curvature, what is the variance. All right. So we wanted to do one more test to say, okay, what if we make synthetic mixtures of genomes? Can we see this? Right? So we took one genome from the genome database that's small, Rickettsia, and we took another genome from the database that's large, Solangium, and we made a mixture. Actually, we made a mixture of 90% Rickettsia and 10% of the very long, of the big genome. And then these dots here are the FC times e to the minus beta C, which is the, right, so this FC times e to the minus beta C is the Laplace transform at 1 minus alpha C. It shows you that as a function of alpha, right? So these are the different dots. And I don't know if you can see this, but these two lines show you what you would have gotten if you had just taken rickettsia, you would have gotten this line, or just taken sorangium, you would have gotten that line. All right? So you see, I don't know how well you can see, this is too thin, but here the blue dots are close to the red line, here they're close to both, and here they're close to the yellow line, right? So even though the effect is small when you look at it at this scale, this slope changes here from lower to steeper, right? And if you actually take these dots and divide them by the slope of just rickettsiae, or just the slope of sorangium, you get this, right? So the red dots is when you divide it by the slope of sorangium, and the blue dots is when you divide it by the slope of rickettsiae. You see that here it turns up and here it turns down. So what this shows is that for these synthetic mixtures that we make from real genomes, yeah, we can see that the data is made up out of genomes with different sizes. Okay. So now this is the real data set that we applied this to start with. So this is a metagenomic data set from 2008 where they looked in different kinds of environments. So subterranean, they had two samples. They had eight sample, marine samples, four freshwater samples, seven from corals, and so on. Right? So they had different samples. And then for each of these samples, we use this pipeline. So again, we didn't do this ourselves. So there's basically a pipeline from this paper where you start with all the reads, you find the ORFs, and then you apply these PFAMs and so on, all these various models. You run over them to get the functional annotation, right? So that's what we did. So we looked at all the PFAM hits. We record the number of reads that map to each of these ORFs, and then we map the PFAM hits to GO categories. And at the end of the day, we get these fractions. It's the fraction of all reads that map to at least one GO category that map to category C. All right, so we get those from these nine biomes. And then we make these plots. All right, so here's two examples. So this is the exponent, and this is sort of this Laplace transform, right? And the blue dots are from a hypersaline sample, and the red dots are from a fish sample. And you see that this suggests, these straight line fits, suggest that the genomes in the fish are bigger than the genomes in the hypersaline.
But it could be just one genome of the fish and one genome
yes.
of the hypersaline.
Right.
Because that they don't curve seem to indicate to me that the whole sample is dominated by one genome.
Precisely. So that's what this shows, right, by not showing anything, sort of, is that if you now divide, so if you look at the residual relative to this straight line fit, you don't see any clear curvature up or down, which would suggest, as you say, that those environments are dominated basically by one genome size. Now, I do want to say, so this is all very preliminary work. And so one of the things is so we try to estimate variances to see if there are some cases where there is positive curvature.
You can actually tell what is the size of this genome, right?
Yeah, I'll get to that. We find, disturbingly, that for quite some fraction of these samples, the curvature is negative. All right. So that if you were to fit a variance, you would have to fit a negative variance, which, you know, unless there's some sort of quantum genomes or something, I don't really see how you get a negative squared number. This makes me think that there might still be some systematic issues that we have to take care of. There may be some amount of viral still in there that is somehow, you know, adding numbers to everybody and screwing up the scaling. I don't know. So we're still working on this. But for the moment, these are the genome sizes that we estimate for these different environments. So I grouped by environments where the samples came from, and I grouped from left to right from the ones that where the biggest genome that I ever estimated was smallest to biggest. So you see that the hypersaline ones, they tend to be smallest, then marine, subterranean, freshwater, microbiolites, terrestrial, corals, and fish. The biggest ones are from fish.
But the fish admits intestine, you know, fish intestine?
Yeah, from inside a fish.
And they don't get contaminated with fish DNA, I presume, because because.
No, no, I don't think so, right? I mean, but, right.
So this shows the mean genome size for each environment?
Yeah, it shows you. So this slope is the log genome size. So then I took the exponent of that, and then I corrected it because we're really counting only the number of domains that have an annotation. So you have to map that to how many genes does that correspond to.
Right? But in principle, this contamination could explain negative curvature because
carriers
do not at all follow the...
Yes, contamination would give you negative curvature. I agree with that. Yes.
Sandy, did you say that you have direct access to the variance of the genome size?
That's what you predict.
I would, yes. If everything goes right, and when we make mixtures synthetically, we've done this stuff, right? Then we can we can estimate it, and it works. But in the real data, it looks like either there is no variance, or in some cases, negative variance. Okay, so there's something we're trying to figure out where this is coming from, right?
Is the GC content?
I haven't looked at it yet. I haven't looked
it's
at
very
it.
It's noisy, right? In,
yes.
So intermediate size,
yes. Yes.
But to the extent that you have some reasonably small ones, you should be able to see the
right. Right. Yes, I agree. So I mean, I think the main thing that I find surprising is that these numbers are very low. Most of them is between 1,000 and 2,000.
So what kind of error estimate would you have on those sizes? Because you're using the scaling laws if it's not,
yeah.
Right, but there's variance around that slope, right?
Well, it's basically the variance in the estimate of this slope here. So you can see, right? I mean, there's some outlier dots that don't behave right, but by and large, you can draw a line through that, and you're pretty. I mean, there's not a lot of range in that slope.
A good proof of principle would be to test your method on one of those metagenomic samples where it did manage to assemble a dominant genome.
I agree.
And so if you can actually get this dominant genome size independently from this.
Right. This is the problem with talking about something that is not finished.
Okay.
Because there's all these things that we need to and want to check, but we simply haven't done yet. All right. I think I'm going to skip this. Okay, so maybe just an advertisement. This is the other work from Nachos. So you said, correctly, somebody said, you said that if your number of transcription factors grows quadratically, then at some point you would have more transcription factors than genes, and that's not possible. But there is another consequence for the topology of transcription regulatory networks. Right? So if you think of a transcription regulatory network as a graph where these colored nodes are transcription factors, and I'm drawing edges from transcription factors to all the genes that they regulate, which may include regulating themselves or regulating other regulators and so on, right? And I count the total number of edges in this network. I can do that in two ways. I can either say, well, let's take the number of regulators and multiply it by the average out degree of these regulators. That gives me the total number of edges. But I could also just say, well, take the total number of genes and multiply it by the average in degree. That's also the total number of edges. Those two numbers have to be the same. So the total number of regulators times the average out degree of transcription factors has to be the same as the average in degree times the total number of genes. But we've seen that this number here, the number of regulators, scales quadratically, right? So that means that in degree over out degree has to be scaling linear with genome size. So as you go from small genomes to large genomes, the large-scale structure of the transcription regulatory network has to change in the sense that the ratio between average in-degree and average out-degree has to grow up linearly. And so there are sort of two limits. One limit is to say, I'm going to assume the out-degree stays constant. Each transcription factor regulates 10 genes, 20 genes, 50 genes, I don't know, but it's the same in small as in big genomes. And it's just that genes in big genomes have more inputs than genes in small genomes. Or, at the other extreme, you can assume that the number of inputs is constant, and that in big genomes, regulators regulate smaller sets of genes. So when we started, when Nacho started doing this, I was convinced that this in degree would go up. Because you say, well, you know, it's a complicated genome, it lives in more environments, it's more complex, so you have more complex regulation of the genes, so you have more inputs. And so the poor Nacho spent 2 years trying to convince me that this is not what the data shows. All right? So eventually he convinced me, and I will not go through why. But basically what we find is that the in degree is totally constant. There's no evidence whatsoever that the number of inputs per gene is going up in bacteria. Also, by the way, intergenic region sizes don't grow in bacteria. But you go very small bacteria, very large bacteria, they all have roughly the same intergenic region size. In eukaryotes, it's not like that at all. So I actually think that this is a key difference between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. In eukaryotes, have worked out ways of putting one gene under the control of many, many, many regulatory elements. Bacteria have never worked this out. You can put regulatory elements right around the start, and after you put 4, 5, 6, it's game over. Cannot put this gene under more inputs. Okay, so I think that this is a fundamental difference. And it means that these regulatory networks in bacteria look like this, right? So if this is a cartoon of your regulatory network with two transcription factors and here non-transcription factor genes, every gene has one input. Now I double the size of the genome. I get 4 times as many regulators, right? So there are now many more colored ones. But the number of inputs stays just 1 per gene. And so the number of outputs went from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 per transcription factor to 2.5 per transcription factor. So as you go from small to large genomes, the number of genes that regulators regulate gets smaller and smaller.
But there is no reason to expect that actually the number of hierarchical levels increases. You will still get the same picture if you have those.
No, that's just to draw a picture.
Right, but it gives me a little message saying that there are two bosses at the top. So each bacterium has like two extra regulators.
But I do find it kind of interesting that if I want to draw a network, then you know I can get the right scaling by assuming that sort of the transcription factor are the internal stuff and the other genes are the ring around it.
You have to make a pyramid, which is a pyramid of regulators. But if you have just the hierarchical trees, this pyramid will be exponential, so it wouldn't really change the scaling. I guess what I'm trying to say is that When you tell people about quadratic scaling, many people who thought about it just a little bit will say, oh, there must be a pyramid, that there are N regulators at the bottom.
No. I agree with you that it doesn't work so simple like that.
Yeah.
So now, this is the last thing that I want to talk about.
Can you talk about the variance around the mean? So you're saying that the mean sort of decreases in terms of this out degree?
Yes. So that would require that I knew the entire distribution for genomes of different sizes. And the only genomes where we know a lot are E. coli and Bacillus subtilis. And even there, we know probably sort of half of what's there. So it is difficult to do that. All right. So now I want to finish by talking a little bit about the wet lab project, which is de novo evolution of promoters. So what we want to look at is constraints that are acting on promoter sequences and, in E. coli. And so I just want to make clear, so Olin, who was here also up to a week ago, so I was lucky enough to manage to convince him to come to run my lab. So he's sort of semi-independent. So this is mainly Olin's project. So we have another project that is sort of, I would say, mainly my project, but I won't talk about this today. And so all this work here is done by Olin and a PhD student, Louise Wolf, is working on this. And so the questions that we were interested in is, how easy is it to evolve promoters starting from random sequences that express at a given level? If you just ask them, I want you to express at this level or at that level, how hard is it starting from totally random sequence to get that? And what are the sequence determinants of the expression level, right? So how many ways are there of doing this? I mean, how many constraints are there actually if all you're asked to do is to express at a certain level? What are the noise properties of evolved promoters in comparison to native ones? And for example, can you evolve promoters that have low or high noise? And so something that we want to do in the future, I haven't started with, is to now also ask them to change their expression level upon, you know, changing the environment, to ask them to say, okay, in different conditions, I want you to express at different levels. All right, so this is the setup of the experiment. So we have a plasmid that has a GFP on it, so a green fluorescent protein, and we had a company make for us random oligomers of about 150 base pair long. So these are random oligomers, and we put those in front of GFP, so we have a library with a large number of these, and then we start by transforming about 2 million cells from this synthetic library. So afterwards, we have a population of E. coli that all have this plasmid, and that there are about 2 million unique random sequences represented in that population. All right, so then the next step is that we can put this population into a fax machine and measure the GFP level of individual cells, and then we can select cells based on having a certain kind of expression. So if this is, you know, the distribution of expression of cells in the population, we can select guys that fall within a certain range. So you can set a gate on your fax machine. That's the nice thing of these fax machines. You can say, everybody that's within this amount of fluorescence, you make it through, everybody else is gone. So we do actually rounds of selection where we select 2,000 cells, 200,000 cells that have a particular fluorescence. And so then after we select cells, we can actually, because the way this construct works is we can cut this piece out of it again. So there is a restriction enzyme sites there, and then we with error-prone PCR we multiply these. So we have a high error rate in this per generation, something like 1 in 50 base pairs or something, a mutation. Then we transform them back, and then we do the next round of selection. So we've done a couple of lines with several rounds of selection. So this is here one example. So this is real data. At day zero, so this is on a log base 10 scale, the distribution of fluorescence in the population. So a lot of it is, this is background. All right, so there's a lot of background fluorescence, but there are some guys here that are actually expressing a bit. This is starting from the total random one, and we've set a target promoter strength here. And so now, after one round of selection, this is the gate we set. So to have, let's say, 5% of the population make it through the gate, we set the gate like this. Anybody above this level could go through. And then after one day, when we again put it in the fax machine, this was the distribution of fluorescence we got. Then we set this gate. Then we got this distribution. At the second day, we got this distribution of fluorescence. Then we set this gate. Then we got this distribution. Now the gate started to become pretty close and centered around this target level. This is at day 4, the distribution of fluorescence. And this is at day 5. All right? So in 5 rounds, you get the population from where almost nobody is expressing at all to basically it's now pretty peaked at this target level that we're asking for. So we wanted to do this in different conditions, and so what we've actually done is we want to select for either high expression. So the previous plot that I showed you, this level here was set by taking native promoters in E. coli. So this, I didn't tell you yet, but Uri Alon's group made a library where every native promoter in E. coli was put in front of GFP. We have access to this too, so we can measure what is the GFP levels of the normal genes in E. coli. And this level here is something like the 90 percentile or 95 percentile. So this is a very high expressing gene. We also took like a 50 percentile, so sort of a median expression gene, and set that as another target to evolve to. Okay?
Where the strongest promoter would be on this scale? I mean, the native, strongest native promoter in E. coli would be.
That would be close to here. I mean, I don't actually know. But I don't think it goes a lot. I mean, I think there are, this thing is close to like ribosomal. It's very high expression. Did you have a question, Boris?
So then this is a strictly a selection on standing variation. You just
no, like no, no, no. So and error prone PCR.
Oh, okay.
Selection, error prone PCR. So
it's a single evolutionary.
Yeah, because we've done this multiple times. I'll show you. Right? So we started from these. So we want to then select for either medium level expression or high level expression, and then either do it all in exponential phase or in stationary phase. So they have two different phases, and so you select for expression in one phase or the other. So we started with our original 2 million unique random oligomers. Then we had one round where we just selected for expression. Right, so just at the high tail of the distribution. And then from then on, we had either five rounds of selecting for medium expression or five rounds selecting for high expression, either in exponential growth phase or in stationary phase. So forget about all these other things. These are all kinds of controls we want to do before we go sequencing these things so that we know how well is selection working, what kind of biases are there in transformation, all these things, right? All kinds of things that you have to worry about. Huh?
Different sigma factors operate in those two phases, right?
Yeah, so here there is the sigma 70 the sigma factor, and here the sigma 54. All right. And we've done each of those four in triplicate, so there were like 12 lines. So there were 12 independent five-generation evolutions, right? So medium level, high level, stationary, or exponential times three. So this is what these curves look like for the distribution of expression in exponential stage evolution. So this is all these guys are being tested in exponential phase, either for median expression or for high expression. So you see for median expression, and so this is generation 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, these colors. So the black is always generation 0, right? So these are mostly guys that are off. And so you see that the medium expression, it shifts over actually pretty fast, right? I mean, already after one generation, the bulk of your thing is already over. For the high expression, it takes longer, right? It's like this curve that I showed you. It sort of pushes itself up and narrows itself down over five generations. What is also, I mean, I think remarkable is if you look at these five curves, you know, they're not the same, but they look very, very, very similar, right? So the distributions that you get in generation 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they're very, very reproducible, right?
How many mutations do you add each round on average?
2 to 3 per promoter. That's sort of the level that we try to set.
So what is the actual target, sir?
This sequence depends on where you set your threshold on this fax machine, or where you set the threshold every round.
So every round, the rule is, you throw your population and you see what is the distribution in your population. And then you say, I'm starting at my target level, and I start opening up my gate until 5% of the population falls inside this gate. And that's the gate that I set.
Do you select on total intensity or on intensity of fluorescence?
Okay, so that's another thing. So when you put something like this to the fax machine, apart from GFP, you can also measure forward and side scatter. And this is somewhat a measure of the size of the cell. And so we set a very, very narrow gate in forward and side scatter, which is essentially the peak of the distribution. So we're hoping to remove variation in size, but I also know that we don't completely remove that. I mean, Mukund Tatai, for example, I talked to him, he studied this in more detail, and it's clear there's only this forward side scatter is a pretty noisy measurement, so there is variation in cell sizes that you don't get rid of in this way. So, all right, so this is an exponential stage evolution, and this is in stationary phase evolution. And you get similar curves. In the for medium expression, you move over very fast. So even after one generation, I mean, the distribution tightens up a little bit, but it goes very fast. In the selection for high expression, it takes longer.
Do you have a sense of what's the noise in mind? If you, for example, took a monoclonal population and did the same thing?
Yes, I'll show you.
What would be the fluorescent photon?
So that's here. So this is the population at day five, and now I take individual clones out of this population. And when we put the clones, they grow up and put them in the fox machine. So these are the distributions that now a single genotype gives in the fox machine. And okay, so Olin selected these to show you a lot of variation. So it's not typical that you get so much variation. Many of them are like this or this, that you get just range. But you do find guys that seem to have, you know, sort of bimodal or much wider distribution. So there is quite some variation in the noise that the individual promoters can have. And the other thing is the width of even ones with low noise is typically bigger than the gate that we set. Right? So we're implicitly also selecting these guys for being not noisy. Right? Because if you're noisy, even though the mean may be right at the target level, if you have a wide distribution, a large fraction of these guys will fall outside the gate and won't make it. Right? So it's good in this setup to be not noisy.
I mean, you could also pick up some cells that are very noisy, but whose mean is very far from the point.
Yeah, but there is of that genotype, a much smaller fraction will make it through. But some will make it through. Like here, this guy. Right? He made it through selecting for this thing because he got lucky. You got one cell that happened to be in this tail, and he made it through. Yeah.
So you started off with 150 base pair library.
Yeah.
And you went PCR is going 150, or you targeted some small one?
No, the whole thing.
Whole thing. And so when you say that you're aiming at the 1-2 mutations, so that's per 150.
Yeah.
Are you doing any sequencing?
Yeah, I'll show you. So actually, I mean, our plan is to actually, with the deep sequencing facility that we have access to follow the whole population. Because there are 200,000 and unique ones per generation. And the Illumina allows you now to do paired end reads that are long enough that you cover the whole thing. And so basically, you can it's then easy to get the entire population and see how it changes through time. And that's where we want to understand sort of what are you really selecting for at the sequence level, what are the constraints. And this is also why, you know, this picture that Louise made shows all the various controls that we also want to sequence. What if you just do one round of selection without error-prone PCR, or you do a replicate of this? Because also taking out this plasmid and putting it back in, transforming it, there may be some sequence biases. We want to know all those things so we can correct for that. I'm almost done. Yes. So what we did is we took 200 individual clones, and we characterized the mean and variance of their expression. So these came from, they were evolved either in exponential growth phase or in stationary phase. Here's the mean expression, and here is standard deviation divided by mean of the expression, right, relative to the mean. These green dots, they were selected for median expression. The blue dots, they were selected for high expression. And the red dots are actually native promoters from E. coli. So you can do this also for native promoters, right? And so what I think is, there's two observations. This is generally up relative to that. So there is more noise in stationary phase than in exponential growth phase. And that's also true for the native promoters in E. coli. The second point is, the evolved promoters have maybe slightly higher noise than the native ones, but very, very little. Right? I mean, the actual where these dots lie is not so different from where the red dots lie. And I think this is actually quite amazing because we started with totally random sequences and we just evolved them for a couple generations. And And these guys are not more noisy typically than native promoters in E. coli, which says that either the native promoters in E. coli don't care that they're noisy, or there is no way for them to get less noisy than they are. All right. So I mean, and then the final thing that we did is we looked at the sequences. So we took 200 sequences and checked what is in there. So what we find is that the 200 sequences that we have, they fall into 150 clusters, right? So here I'm showing you one cluster that has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sequences in it. So what that means, right, is that when we started from these 2 million guys and we ran these lines, it means that in different lines, the same ancestor from here was evolved through time. All right? So it tells you that from this sample of 2 million, there's some guys that you see multiple times, even if you just take 200. All right? So that's what this is. And here I'm showing you the distribution. Oh, the second thing is that each cluster has only sequences that were selected on the high or selected on the low. So we never find the same ancestor that made it through a medium selection line and through a high selection line. It's either all high or all low. This is the distribution of cluster sizes. So you see that most clusters are still length 1, so about 50-60% of the clusters are length 1. But in the high expression case, you find bigger clusters, and you find even a cluster that has 20 in it. So it's sort of 10% of the population are offspring of this individual gene. And then just to, you know, want to wrap up, but so in E. coli, so the main candidate of sequence that determines expression is the binding site of the sigma 70 core promoter. And this core promoter, so here's a picture that I stole from the web. It has these two boxes that are specific patterns. So at minus 10, there is this Tata box. And at minus 35, there's the TTGACA box. And so what I actually did is I took, so Regulon DB has a collection of several hundred known sigma 70 promoters where the start site has been experimentally determined. And then I use this motif finding algorithm. So this is part of the other kind of work that I do. To have these algorithms that you give a set of sequences and they look for motifs in these sequences. When you run this motif-finding algorithm on the known sigma 70 promoters, these are the two top motifs that you find, right? So you see, this is this Tata motif, right? This matches this canonical known motif here, but you see that there's quite some noise at these letters here. And up here is this minus 35 motif, TTG, and then this ACA, but these are also not as well defined. So it's a pretty fuzzy motif, but these are sort of the canonical 2 feet of the sigma 70 polymerase in E. coli. And so what I then did is I selected from each cluster of sequences, I selected one sequence. And then I just ran the motif-finding algorithm. And these are the top two motifs that you find, right? So what this shows is that in these sequences, if you take a motif-finding algorithm that knows nothing but is just going to look for overrepresented sequences, the top two motifs that it finds are, in fact, looking pretty much like the canonical minus 35 and minus 10 box of the sigma factor, which is maybe just what you expect, right? You expect that what these things are evolving is binding sites. Then I'll show you too. So if you look at, now you can make different longer motifs by putting the left foot and then spaces of different length in the right foot, and then you ask how many sites do I see in my evolved sequences as a function of space or length, and you see that the most common one is 17, and that's the canonical one. 18 you also see, but you actually see quite a number of the other ones too, right? I don't know which one of those are really functional. You do see enrichment of the canonical one, but the enrichment is not dramatic, right? Okay. And then the observation that I find most interesting is then when I run with the canonical one, right, with the 17, and ask where are the binding sites that I find relative to the end of my promoter, then you see that they totally bunch up at the end of the promoter. Okay? So these promoters want to have the sigma factor binding site right at the end of the sequence. For some reason, it's not good to put your sigma factor site in the middle of this 150 base pair thing. You want to have it at the end. And my interpretation of this is that somehow the stuff that you then include in the RNA, right? Because if you put it in the middle, then this piece will be in the RNA, somehow may interfere with translation or something like this, right? So that it's more robust to put it at the end. But, and this is the last slide, I can't see any clear difference, and I've done this analysis basically while I was here because the data is very new, between sigma 70 binding sites in high expressing and medium expressing promoters. Right? So if you look at some of the canonical motifs, there are a bit more sites in high expressing than medium expressing ones, but if you do a statistical test, it's not significant. So I can't see any signal yet of which says this is a high expressor or this is a medium expressor. Clearly they have sigma 70 sites and they're overrepresented, the lack of sit at the end of the sequence, but what says the level? I don't know. So now I'm done. Thank you very much.
So you know you're starting with a random sequence.
Yeah.
You know you have five generations of one population size. So is it plausible that you can sort of try to estimate the probability of getting a weight matrix from a sort of cold start with a few mutations? So is this consistent?
Yes, so I haven't done that calculation, but I have no reason to believe that it's not consistent, because...
Well, one would hope that it is, but it's...
So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, at most 8 base pairs, right? I don't really think it is 8 because you can have probably different spacers, right? So 4 to the 8 is 2 to the 16, 1 in 64,000. We had 2 million, right? I mean, not so hard.
But the suitable position is another constraint, right?
Right.
You don't have any recombination mode, your mutation.
Yeah, but I summed the...
Okay.
So that would mean you don't really need your error from PCR, right? It would just be from that.
Yeah.
But is that true? I mean, if you just run from your standing variation, you still get the same result?
I don't think we will get the same result, but I do think you can get high expressors. Yeah, that's a good question. We should do that. I mean, I would like to introduce error-prone PCR because we want to actually look at the population and understand what are actually the constraints. So I want to see how much can you mess with these things and nothing will happen. And that's harder to see if I don't do any mutations at all.
You also want to know sort of the volume of phase space. You want to know what's the probability of finding your bindings.
Right. So now the fact that in the 200 sequences that we sequenced, there were 115 unique ones from that 2 million, you already know that there's not just one way of doing it, right? But from the fact that one guy you saw 20 times, you also know that there weren't a million ways of doing it, right? But and clearly we can put some numbers on this, but I simply haven't done it yet.
But the striking thing about your result is not that you find many ways, but you sort of find the canonical way back. So that's why it's, despite the fact that you gave ample room for novel mutations to occur and find alternative solutions, that's what I find most surprising.
Right, so the one thing
more
that I...
uniqueness rather than...
Right, so the one thing... Okay, so this is going a bit, and again, this is incredibly preliminary because I've just been looking at these sequences since I've been here. But if I say you're allowed to look for a longer motif than 6, so this is when you run with length 6, which is the length that people typically put for those feet of the sigma factors. And I say, okay, I'll run with 9. I do see some extra bases with information here, right? The thing that that I noticed is that there is this TGC here in front of the Tata. And, okay, so, but I also look for sigma 54 binding sites, right? Because we have also stationary state, right? And sigma 54 binding sites, I don't find very much overrepresented. But I do notice that if I look at the relative position of putative sigma 54 and putative sigma 70 sites, you find a high overrepresentation that they sit overlapping. And they're precise, that would precisely be this TGC, TATA. This would be a pattern that where you could put down both a sigma 70 and a sigma 54, and they both are consistent with this. So this is a preliminary observation, but it might be true that what we see is these guys are evolving promoter sites that can be used by both sigma factors. But it is certainly true that I don't see anything totally novel. I mean, the top things are the sigma 70 sites.
So how much this window with like the width of selection, this 5% of population that you're constrained?
Why 5? Why did we pick 5%?
Yeah, and how much it affects actually your observation, like saying.
Well, it was sort of
one.
Okay, so I don't know the answer because I don't think Louise has runs with a different percentage. But I can tell you that one of the reasons why we did that is we wanted to allow as much variation, but keep the population size small enough that in the end we can sequence everything and see everything that was in the population and still pay for it. Right, because how many lanes I can do and so on is dependent on if I want to catch everybody in the population, right, I need to sequence it at a certain depth. And the smaller I set this window, the smaller the fraction of the population makes through, and then I control how much variability there is maximum in the population. So it's also so it's fairly arbitrary, but it's constrained by follow-up experiments we want to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know how big this 5% is and how much selection is there. So are you surprised to see that you observe basically like one motif because it was selected sometime very early, or if you just allow it to be a bit bigger, then you see it, like alternative promoter structures?
No, because we do see alternative structures, right? There are 115 unique ones among our 200. So it's not that the population is dominated by just one or two types. There's lots of diversity there. But if you look at what is in those things, they all seem to have these binding sites for the polymerase. And it's not so surprising, right? Because, I mean, molecular biology says you need to bind the polymerase to transcribe. So you better have a binding site for the polymerase.
So here's the other way maybe to ask the question is if you look at some other site, like this 150, how much variable, I mean, is there sort of, so if the selection happened very early,
yeah,
then you would see that not only this part has a characteristic motif, but if you pick any, let's say first 10 or any other 10 somewhere in the middle of the motif, you would see.
Right. So the only answer I can give to that is that we haven't really sort of looked at it systematically, but what we have done, when we cluster these sequences, you do pairwise comparison of all sequences, and then you say, if they align and they're identical over some level, I consider them a cluster. So there we really find that those guys that we cluster, they're more than 90% identical. But any of these clusters, there's basically no, they look like independent sequences. Yes.
From what you said, I understand that your optical density window is put at for young cells, small mass, because it's the peak in the distribution. So that's also the highest phenotypic variability. Have you tried to move that window to?
No, we haven't. And I'm not sure. I mean, I would have to ask Olin before. I mean, I'm wondering why you're so confident that the peak of that distribution in forward side scatter corresponds to the
other
cells.
There are always twice as many daughters than old mothers, so the peak has to be at for young cells.
Uh, And then why are those the most noisy?
Because they are the smallest. They have the smallest number. And
yeah, oh, but this, okay, that's good that you mentioned this. And then maybe people want to have lunch. So this is standard deviation by mean, all right? The measure of noise. And there's basically, if there was Poisson noise, right, standard deviation by mean would go like 1 over square root mean. We're here pretty much in the regime where it's flat, all right? So we're here in the regime where the noise is not dominated by small number counts. The noise is dominated by extrinsic fluctuations, fluctuations in the availability of polymerase, availability of ribosomes.
For small numbers.
No. This is not small number fluctuation. Because if you go down here, then at some point you will see this is paper by Sonic CA who's done this, right? Where you see that at this lower level, then you do get the Poisson scaling. But here you're in a regime where the fluctuation doesn't scale anymore with the number, right? So this is a factor 10, right? And you don't see.